This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. Right now, Japan is hosting the World Cup of Rugby. In some ways, it's a small-scale test run for this summer when Tokyo hosts the Olympics and the Paralympics. It's also part of a push by Japan's central government to develop tourism, which has already grown more than expected over the last few years. The government has set a goal of 40 million visitors by 2020, up from a little more than 31 million last year. A few months ago, I traveled to Tokyo on a fellowship from the Foreign Press Center of Japan to take a closer look at how those plans are being managed. I went to the district where most government ministries are clustered, Kasumigaseki, and to the Ministry of Land, Infrastructure, Transport, and Tourism, home to the government's Japan Tourism Agency. I spoke with Yashiro Taguchi, whose title is Director for Visitor Experience Improvement. While we talked about preparations for visitors during the Olympics, we also talked about the caution some have about a relatively quick rise in the number of international visitors. He told me the central government recently sent out a survey to more than 200 municipalities around the country about the growth of tourism.
Most of them have some concerns, some level of concerns on the congestion issue. That's not caused only by the foreign tourists, but the Kyoto or Kamakura has been already congested by Japanese tourists. But on top of that, the increasing foreign tourists has been putting pressure on the tourist destinations. And also, because of these smartphones or social network, people suddenly come to some undiscovered areas, like the streets behind my house and the sacred or holy spots of some cartoons. For example, some railroad crossing in Kamakura is now flooded by the foreign tourists. And that's in the middle of the residential area. It's quite a beautiful scenery with the train with the white ocean on the back. But the thousands of tourists come to this area and are taking photos of trains and are causing some noises or the garbage issues. The people are really upset. So it's not still a really critical level, but it's happening gradually.
Mm. Are you concerned about supply of hotel rooms?
During the Olympic Games?
Mm.
We do have actually some concerns. According to a really quick survey to the hotel owners and the management, they say the rooms are quite packed already.
Those hotel rooms may be quite packed already, but a new option has been added for visitors to Japan in recent years, vacation rentals. They're known as minipaku, and they're tightly regulated. Each area can set its own rules, in some locations even down to when visitors need to be in for the night and need to be quiet. That concept of how one's actions can affect others is a big part of Japanese society, and it's one where some foreigners can use some reminders or perhaps a little education. Here's Yoshiro Taguchi again from the Japan Tourism Agency about what he calls smart behavior for visitors.
Many municipalities already has made some the brochures or leaflet or even videos to let people know what is smart and what is smart behavior. So that kind of the awareness campaign may work. So even us in the government, we really want to try what is the best way to educate the kind of smart behaviors during the stay.
Tourism is so important to Hawaii. There's a big debate in terms of numbers and targets and focus, mm-hmm. not just on
quantity.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And for you now, not just the raw numbers.
We have more the goals, like the consumption level. It's easy to increase the number by riding more from the nearby countries. But generally speaking, nearby country, the tourists from nearby countries stay shorter and spend less. We need to balance both the quantity and quality. Mm. And quality means not just the manner or the kind of cultural things, but also we want them to spend more for the quality products. Mm. Another goal is we want to diversify the portfolios, so the source markets. Mm-hmm. So we want to have more tourists from the United States and the European countries or Australia, because they tend to spend more, and spend means stay more, stay longer, and spend more.
As we got to the end of our conversation at the Japan Tourism Agency, I came back to a question that I really had to ask, especially as someone coming to Tokyo from Hawaii.
Do you worry at all about too many tourists?
Actually, I shouldn't say not at all. Mm-hmm. But it's everybody in this organization believes it's manageable if we execute the proper policies. It's not easy thing, but it's doable and manageable, I believe. We have plenty of destinations beyond Tokyo and Kyoto. If all the passengers should be maybe welcomed by Tokyo City and Kyoto City only, that might be quite hard. But Tokyo still has the capacity of accommodation will be increased more and more. So we are not worried about the Tokyo's capacity. But still, some areas like Kamakura or Kyoto, those are traditional towns, may have some that capacity issue. They try to diversify the visit by time and season and destinations inside the Kyoto. So that's also awareness campaign by informing that this place by certain time and season will be really congested. So it might be better to visit this temple in the early morning and in the spring season, for example. Yeah, we of course welcome many visitors from the Hawaii and the United States, and we have more and more the flights to yes. Hawaii, and A380 will be introduced. And so not just the Japanese tourists going to Hawaii, but we want to welcome more Hawaiian tourists to Japan. And also we really want to learn more from the Hawaii in terms of that sustainable tourism. We understand that there are lots of good examples in the Hawaii.
That was Yoshiro Taguchi, the Director for Visitor Experience Improvement at the Japan Tourism Agency in Tokyo. In coming weeks, we'll return to some other perspectives from Japan about the growth of tourism, preparations for visitors coming to next year's Olympics, and how politics can affect tourism numbers, including a steep fall in visitors to Japan from South Korea. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we look back at a political movement that gained prominence in the early days of territorial Hawaii. Soon after the United States annexed Hawaii, many Native Hawaiians worried that neither the Democratic nor the Republican Party would represent their interests. That led to the creation of the Hawaiian Home Rule Party. Founded by Robert Wilcox, the party's motto was Equal Rights for the People. In a speech to the two main Hawaiian political clubs at the time, Wilcox said, "The question of the restoration of the monarchy is gone from us forever. We are now a people, however, who can vote." In the Home Rule Party's first election, it beat the ruling Republican Party to win a majority in the territorial Senate. While the party initially enjoyed success and the support of Prince Jonah Kuhio, it won few allies across the aisle. It was also a target of criticism from establishment newspapers. Prince Kuhio would leave the party in 1902, and following Wilcox's death in 1903, the party would gradually lose steam. The Hawaiian Home Rule Party disbanded in 1912. But did you know that it was founded under an entirely different name? For today's Backyard Quiz, can you tell us the original name for the Hawaiian Home Rule Party? If you know, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. First one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from PBS Hawaii, presenting live What's It Going to Take?, an executive forum on making life better in Hawaii, 8 p.m. tomorrow, pbshawaii.org.
Agriculture plays a much different role in the islands than it used to, and that role is still evolving. It touches on issues from food production to climate change. But there's another point. Who's interested in pursuing agriculture as a career, as a way of life? HBR's Noe Tanigawa talked with a couple of agriculture students who do see a future in this.
Yes, it's fun to find them. It really is, Bill. I mean, a number of high schools around the state have agriculture career tracks, but this last week I hopped on over to Lelehua High School in Wahiawa, and there I met Julita Ahonima and Marvin Estikol. They're seniors in the natural resources pathway that they have up there. It's led by Jackie DeChepko. And what Lelehua's got is this kind of amazing 3-plus-acre farm. They've got the eggplant, broccoli, lettuces, beets. They've got hydroponics, aquaponics, and they've got chickens too. And they do sell all their produce right there in the community.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to be looking at a job market where people are going to offer you $30, $40 an hour to do construction, or you can do like culinary or farm kind of work for like $15 an hour, you know?
Yeah, I'd still prefer the culinary or the farm kind of work because I'd rather be doing something I love for a little pay than be doing something I don't like.
What kind of farm jobs are there, do you think?
Yeah, well, being in ag, you learn a lot of things. So you learn, well, you learn how to communicate more with others and you meet a lot of new people and you learn how to be more independent. People think that ag is just like farming and stuff, but it's really not. You learn more than just farming here. We had an ag conference, what was it?
Tuesday, Wednesday,
yeah.
Where?
At the convention.
You guys went!
Yeah, we were there.
Well, how was it?
It was good. It was a very fun experience to meet a lot of people, and students had speeches and stuff, and it was really cool to hear about their different projects. We saw like a variety of different farmers and like how they started up their business from small. I know the people who help small farmers to get somewhere.
But UH was there.
Yeah, UH Manoa was
there.
She was trying to get us to put an application.
Yeah. Would you guys do that?
Yeah, I was actually talking to my counselor today about it.
I'm actually in the process of filling mine out.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that's a way to go to continue school somehow?
Yeah, I say if you wanted to like start your own ag business, continuing school is a very smart idea because people don't know like the behind the scenes of an agriculture-related workplace.
They really don't. It's kind of amazing, Bill, everything that goes on because there are certifications you've got to get. I mean, there are chemicals you work with. But you really wonder, what is the job market like for ag and where are we going? Well,
That's one question, actually, that a lot of people have been talking about lately. So I got together with Sidney Kili'ipuleole. He's with the Agricultural Leadership Foundation of Hawaii, and he was the chair of that 2019 Hawaii Ag Conference. Now, Mr. Kili'ipuleole says the big picture really is not just ag, it's Hawaii's whole food system, and he wants us to look at the parts of that system. Agriculture, he says, has flipped just in the last 25 years. I mean, from plantations to small farmers, that's a huge change in culture.
So our theme was to provide mindset, courage, ideas to basically the small farm industry we have in Hawaii. Yes, there are a few corporate farmers, but for the most part, we're 10 acres, we're 5 acres, maybe we're 20-acre farmers. Sometimes there are a lot of issues with consistency of supply. I think in order for our farming food system market to thrive here, it's really the idea of collaboration and aggregation. So I think it's really about the old idea of co-ops.
Whoa. I mean, I was kind of interested to hear him get to that, you know? But Mr. Kili'ipuleole says we have to literally get our stuff together to move the whole system forward, because aggregating solves problems with equipment, food safety, energy, consistency, supply. And he gave an incredible example, the Hawaii Ulu Cooperative that's based on Hawaii Island. I was checking them out, Bill, and it's heartwarming. I mean, they've got 70-plus member farms that are in all the microclimates across that island, and they grow at least 6 distinct breadfruit varieties. So they kind of take advantage of all the different, growing seasons. That's the way they can manage to supply Ulu virtually year-round, and all the processing, the marketing, the distribution is centralized. I mean,
that's an interesting point. And also the students touched on it too, that there's production, but there's also distribution is such a key part of this. And when people sometimes think of farming with a capital F, they don't bring that in their consciousness as well.
Right. Mr. Kili'ipuleole was saying, you know, these people can farm, right? But, you know, And we're so lucky that we have all these farmers markets. But how many farmers have time to go to a farmers market for a day or half a day or a whole day, 3-4 times a week? I mean, it's really tough. He says that what's really missing, too, is that creative and maybe super lucrative connection to consumers. It's that processing, the value added, and like you were saying, build the distribution and marketing. Now, how can we approach that problem? He said, look at it this way. Agriculture is actually a multitude of industries that are supported by our food system. Okay, we got agriculture, and that supports culinary, which supports tourism. He said the military here also is part of the overall food system. He says the DOE is intimately tied into the food system, large scale, every day. So what he wants is if all these partners could get together, then he says we could create the kind of food system we want. Oh, what would that look like? Well, there are two messages from the Ag Conference keynote speaker that they brought in from Aotearoa, New Zealand. His name's Jamie Tu'uta. He's the chair of the New Zealand Tourism Board. Tu'uta said, government support is crucial for agricultural success. He said in Aotearoa, New Zealand, this is their winning combination. Culture plus agriculture plus ecotourism. Tu'uta also said collaborative leadership can build that whole vision for the future.
The farmer knows how to farm. He does that very well. Being small farms in Hawaii, farmers don't have time to promote, to market, to pack and store, to put it up on the web, not only for the folks here in Hawaii, but for Japan, California.
You're talking about vaulting our products onto the international market.
The Hawaii brand means a lot. It commands a premium.
Does maybe some kind of picture come together, Bill?
And so, you know, I keep coming back to the pragmatic side of the transportation involvement, the distribution involvement, and yes, marketing and things. I mean, it's you go to someplace like South Korea and where they're coffee crazed, and even the idea of using the word Hawaii, anything having to do with Hawaii, even if it's not Hawaii coffee, is a draw. But I mean, it is, as you point out, and as the people that you spoke with point out, it's a broader context for that. It's really looking at it in a different way, right?
And getting some different people to the table to try to solve this problem. I mean, when you're talking about DOE, he says the healthcare system here really relies on it. When we all get together, we can design the kind of system we want to have, and it's going to help everybody and resiliency too.
And again, getting this, getting the young folks interested and involved and deeply involved in this early on. That's great. Noe Tani Gao, you know her. She covers arts and cultures and ideas at HPR. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks, Noe.
Thank you.
His stories make you laugh, cry, cringe, or all three. His groundbreaking radio show, This American Life, has led to countless driveway moments. And for the first time ever, public radio pioneer Ira Glass is coming to Oahu for one night only. Join HPR and Hawaii Theater Center for his show, Seven Things I've Learned, Saturday, December 21st. We're giving HPR members early access to the best seats now, before the general public. Get yours at hprtickets.org.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll find out about an educational tool to help connect students with internships and job opportunities. We'll learn about the Education Bridge, which is like a Match.com service to help students explore the business world and prepare for life after graduation. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
It's a sadly familiar story for many public spaces in the islands, and especially in the city of Honolulu. Homeless people move into an area like a park, and it falls out of use by others. That's happened to one piece of land downtown, and the city council is proposing an unusual solution. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Christina Jedra has a story on that online today, and she joins us with more. And Christina, thanks for coming on. And this proposed solution does sound unusual.
The council is considering a measure that would basically repurpose this mini park, Kamali'i Mini Park, which is downtown, and it kind of, instead of focusing on the homeless individuals specifically, they'd rather just kind of close the park as it is now and put it into other use.
And it's interesting in terms of just the other use, and again, I know the park area that you're talking about, and it's not a massive sweeping park as some people might imagine. It's more sort of again, I use the phrase public space, just a little area. I don't know, in terms of options or other uses, what are they talking about?
Yeah, so this is a small grassy area with concrete planters and walkways. It's not like Ala Moana or anything like that. It's less than an acre. And it's right behind the Baratania Street fire station. So one of the potential alternatives is just expanding the fire station or taking the land into the fire department's use and see what they can do with it. But according to Councilwoman Carol Fukunaga, whose district this is, the area has really become overwhelmed with drug use, unpermitted camping, public urination, and has basically become a hangout for homeless individuals. So they're hoping to change that.
And the police are supportive of this, I imagine, in part because they wind up spending a lot of time dealing with complaints in and around that area, yes?
That's right. So the city is supportive of it, the Parks Department, police, and the fire department as well. They're hoping they can, I guess, spend less resources on enforcing things in the park and focus their efforts elsewhere.
And I notice, as you include in as part of the story, the executive director of the Outdoor Circle had a different view of all of this.
That's right. Yeah, the news has sparked a bit of discussion. Winston Welch, director of the Outdoor Circle, called the potential closure of the park a sad indictment of the city. He felt that it's a shame that the city hasn't been able to maintain the park and enforce its laws. And other folks kind of criticized the move as well. They question where are the homeless people going to go. If they go to another park, the city will have to close that as well. And other folks are just saying homelessness is a national crisis, and we really need to just invest in services like substance abuse programs and mental health programs and affordable housing. And that, you know, these problems aren't going to stop if you just close parks. That you have to get to the root causes.
You know, it's interesting. One aspect of stories online at Civil Beat and elsewhere are the comments that you get from readers as well as part of it. And I noticed that on your story, some folks are suggesting, you know, or asking if the Outdoor Circle really wants to improve Connolly Mini Park, you know, get in touch with the neighborhood board and talk about something that is pragmatic as an alternative.
Yeah, it's kind of unclear what the alternative use will be. Right now, the city's just making the first move to start the discussion and remove it from the park department's inventory, and we'll have to wait and see what they dream up as the vision for Kamali'i Mini Park going forward.
We will see what happens with that and keep an eye on that. That is Bill 52 also, by the way, would allow City Parks Director to close parks at night, sort of a related issue.
That's right, yeah. So anyone in the park after hours would be facing financial penalties and potentially imprisonment if they're in the park when they're not supposed to be.
All right, Christina. Well, thanks very much for your report.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read Christina Jedra's full story online at civilbeat.org. We are still more than a year away from the next presidential election, but from a lot of the media coverage, it may seem a little closer. A pair of recent studies give some indication about how voters are looking at the election. Our columnist Neil Milner is here with some thoughts on that in today's edition of The Long View. And Neil, there seem to be some bigger picture views on this that really go to sort of the mind frame of voters.
Yeah, I see you couldn't get through that line about closer without laughing.
Well,
good reason.
True.
Yeah, I'll try not to laugh. Yes, there's two things going on. One, if you want to look at it simply, one is about the candidates and the other is about the voters. And I wanted to take a look at the voters this time. So there are two very interesting studies that have emanated from the Voter Studies Group, which is a bipartisan, nonpartisan, really, group that has sponsored some very large-scale samples, some very sophisticated research. And they took a look at two things that I think it's important to understand right now, and that is how committed people are to candidates and how much identity politics is playing a role in the presidential campaign. So, and both of those things have important significance for what's going to be developing toward 2020. So just a very brief summary of them. The John Sides, in his study of identity politics, says there is no question, whatever the parties are saying about trying to reduce identity politics, it's not about race, it's not about, it definitely is in terms of the voters, that identity politics, particularly views on immigration, is the dominant difference maker right now between Democrats and Republicans.
And just a quick pause or an asterisk on this. Identity politics.
Yes.
How would you define that or term that?
I guess the best way to define it is politics that sees the world primarily through race and gender and, to some extent, class. So it's almost about tribalism. And tribalism has a bad connotation, but think of it as a good connotation. You're thinking of the world in terms of tribes, your tribes. How do you protect those sort of things? Identity, how do you protect and how do you enhance African-American identity, gender identity, or fluid gender identity, and how, in fact, which is the corresponding thing to this, is that we want to protect white identity. So, you know, saying it is a little bit frightening to lots of people, and I think with good reasons, because it can be very disruptive and very fluid. At the same time, it's been a powerful factor. And the factor has been particularly powerful in one way with the Democrats and a different way with the Republicans. The Democrats have a kind of coalition of many kinds of racial and ethnic groups, predominantly non-white, and they tend to emphasize that kind of the protection of various kind of subcultures. The Republican Party is essentially a white person's party now, and so they emphasize in subtle sort of ways, sometimes not so subtle, is the limits of thinking about minorities and other kinds of things, and the necessity to think about us as white people. The message is seldom that direct, although it certainly is in some elements of the Republican Party. So that's what it is. If you want to think about a difference, here's a very simple way to think about the difference. If you look at how Republicans and Democrats, these are voters, think about health care, Obamacare, there is a difference. Democratic voters are more supportive than Republican voters. If you look at attitudes toward race and you look at attitudes toward immigration, according to this study, the Democratic voters and the Republican voters are much more polarized. And on immigration issues, they've become increasingly polarized. Less than 10 years ago, there wasn't that much difference on attitudes toward immigration, either legal or illegal, between Democrats and Republicans. Thanks to the movement of the Democratic voters to the left, they're much more supportive of immigrants than they used to be. That's now become a very salient and very clear polarizing issue. And it seems to have more to do with which party you identify with. That is, the party you identify with determines your view on immigration, not the other way around. And that, of course, is a different way of looking at voting, where the idealized way is that you have a policy position and you search around for a party that supports it, which has not been the case according to any kind of research anywhere, but it's very clear here.
You know, it's interesting also on the specifics of immigration policy in particular, sort of the atmosphere that you're describing also means that in a legislative setting, there's much less middle room in terms of compromise, in terms of a policy achievement on a pragmatic basis.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And the people who can tell you this the best are Republicans who are not quite as conservative, old-line Republicans. Just ask George W. Bush. Just ask, the late senator from Arizona, and just ask George Romney. They were very clear at one time to be much more supportive of immigrants and very candid about why they moved away from that, because their party, other party elites, had moved away from it. It's interesting to look at what this is all about in lots of ways. You know, if you see it as prejudice or racism or so on, you miss the point. If you see it as poor whites fighting back, you miss the point. There's some recent research that shows that the strongest supporters of Trump in 2016 were non-college-educated white people, particularly white males, who are not that poor, who are kind of middle class. And if you look at the kinds of people that they are, a lot of them are small shopkeepers, small business. They make middle class money, but their lives are not. They feel that they're threatened by the knowledge economy just as everybody else is. So there's this kind of sense of vulnerability out there that gets translated into worrying about the other. So that's clearly one of the things that's, and John Seitz basically says you know, it's there. It's going to be there. And you know, we don't know what's going to happen with impeachment, but my estimate is that whatever happens there, this is going to continue to be a significant issue because it's gotten into the core of supporters of both parties, and there's no indication that party elites, as you suggested, or elected officials are going to move anywhere toward a compromise position.
And it's interesting also when you come down to the points of either making policy on the legislative front or from more of an executive leadership perspective of suggesting policy or perhaps platform, think of that as a party platform going into a presidential election. What sort of impacts does that have?
Well, the impact is generally going to be polarizing. I have a piece coming out tomorrow on Civil Beat where I start by essentially saying national politics is become more and more of a failure. And I quote an ex high-level political official who worked for both Bushes in the presidential. And he says, here's the problem. He said, you don't have policymakers anymore. You have culture warriors. And they're much more interested in protecting their own and destroying others than they are in anything else. And I think that's a pretty useful. I think that's a pretty useful way of putting things. I should say I offer some alternatives of a different kind of politics to talk about it. But I think that's. I don't see anything that's happening in Congress that is going to change that kind of dynamic. Certainly, the impeachment process is reinforcing it, and so the. I think that's where we stand.
You know, that line that you have about culture warriors, not policymakers, and in the midst of an impeachment investigation, it's hard not to climb back into the time machine and think Newt Gingrich.
Yes. Well, I mean, Newt Gingrich is still a culture warrior. He's more obstreperous than that, and he's a little different than a lot of other politicians and a lot of other conservatives. He's a little, how can I put this, idiosyncratic. But still, when all is said and done, this is what Newt Gingrich is, and he helped to build the Republican Party along those lines. But I want to make it clear that culture warrior, that certainly the Republican Party over the years has moved more away from the center than the Democratic Party is. I mean, statistically, you can document that. But politics now is very much about culture warring, and that gets back to the politics of identity. And some of these splits that you see within the Democratic primary and the candidates right now is really about that, where it's a very difficult task for Democratic candidates because they tend to want to appeal to these basic constituencies. And like in early races, you move a little bit more to the extremes. But you can certainly see that dynamic. You can hear how Joe Biden tries, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, to talk about other things. And you can hear how some of the moderate candidates try to take a broader perspective. But culture wars are still out there.
Polarization in politics. Who would have thought that?
if you were sentient in the last 10 to 20 years, you would have thought of it.
Neil Milner, he's a retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Maui Chamber Orchestra's season premiere, featuring works by Gershwin and Borodin and Schubert's String Quintet in C, October 27th at Kihei Baptist Chapel. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we took a look at an early political party in Hawaii's territorial days. The Hawaiian Home Rule Party emerged as a third party following Hawaii's annexation and focused much of its policy on helping Native Hawaiians and other underserved communities in the new territory. Founded in part by Robert Wilcox, the party enjoyed strong populist support and the involvement of Prince Jonakahio, Its goals were ambitious. Among other policies, the Hawaiian Home Rule Party sought to establish schooling for poor Hawaiians, better serve residents of Kalapapa, and provide aid to the victims of the 1900 Chinatown fire. But the party had a short life. It won few allies in Congress, and it was the constant target of Republican obstructionism and attacks from the media to discredit its primarily Hawaiian-led caucus. The party languished under poor leadership following the death of Robert Wilcox and eventually was disbanded in 1912. Founded originally as the Independent Home Rule Party, the Hawaiian Home Rule Party leaned toward more centrist policies and views to provide territorial citizens an alternative to the primarily Democratic and Republican priorities of the day. While the Hawaiian Home Rule Party has been gone for more than 100 years, a small tribute to the former party exists today in the form of a small stretch in Honolulu. You can find Home Rule Street near the waterfront in Kalihi, fittingly tucked between Democrat Street and Republican Street. And we had a winner today. Sid Hoffeld on the Big Island in Pahoa knew that. She knew that because she's been reading up on Hawaii's political history. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Today in Hong Kong, the government formally withdrew the extradition treaty that sparked street protests this spring that grew and deepened over the summer and early fall. It's not going to end the demonstrations, which are now a feature of life in the city every weekend. Frank Ching is a syndicated columnist who's lived in Hong Kong since 1984. He opened the Wall Street Journal's bureau in Beijing back in 1979, making him one of the first four American newspaper reporters to be based in that city since before the Communist Revolution. He also reported for the New York Times and the Far Eastern Economic Review. He was just in Honolulu, where he spoke at this month's China seminar at the East-West Center. He also made some time to stop by our studios to talk about life in Hong Kong these days, starting with what he feels is one important fact to consider about the protests.
Nobody has been killed, but I think that there's a grave danger that any day somebody could be killed, and then you'd have another escalation, which would make things harder to control. As it is, it's very hard for the Hong Kong police to contain these riots. There are only 30,000, 31,000 people in the police force, and the protesters outnumber them greatly. Like when Carrie Lam announces anti-mask law.
Right.
I'm sure they expected that when it came into effect at midnight, a lot of people would come out in defiance and wear masks. And that happened all across Hong Kong. But there weren't policemen all across Hong Kong able to make these arrests. The government made a decision and then was not able to enforce it because it doesn't have the manpower. There are not enough policemen to do this job. And at bottom, this is not a police problem. This is a political issue that the government is not handling properly. It's just letting the police handle this political problem and politicizing the police and making relationship between the public and the police very bad. Now, a lot of people now hate the police.
And violence in the street complicates the politics of the situation as well.
Yes, it does. Uh-huh. And I think that it's true that there have been cases of police abuse of power, and there is a almost universal demand for an independent investigation by a judge or a group of judges. And Carrie Lam simply would not accept this.
When you look at what is a way out of this, what is a peaceful exit?
And it's hard to see how this is going to end. I mean, if the numbers continue to drop and the police manage to regain control, the government can then restore order in Hong Kong. Seems like this is going to be a very long, drawn-out process, especially because of the great resentment that so many people have now against the police. I think that this is very difficult for the police to do, and I think Carrie Lam may find that the police are not capable of doing this. Everybody, the Chinese government, the Hong Kong chief executive, the Hong Kong police, they all want this to be contained within Hong Kong. But in the end, this may not be possible, and the Hong Kong government may call on China for help, in which case the PLA and most likely the People's Armed Police will be deployed in Hong Kong. But then that will put a lot of the protesters in jail, and a lot more soldiers than there are policemen, potentially. And China can deploy a lot of troops into Hong Kong. But then what do you do after that?
And an incident like that would change the very nature of Hong Kong itself to the world.
How would the world view Hong Kong after that? That's a very serious problem. I think that there is also a possible bright side to look at, which is I think the Hong Kong government has learned a lesson. They cannot operate as a government without taking account of public opinion, like Carrie Lam has done. And the Chinese government, I think, should also learn. Under the Basic Law, the chief executive is accountable to both the Chinese government and the people of Hong Kong. So I think that this ought to teach China a lesson. It is not enough for China to trust the chief executive. The people of Hong Kong also have to trust the chief executive.
But the phrase with China, internal matter, is something that is just such a bright, shining line that is not crossed.
But Hong Kong is part of the internal situation in China. The people of Hong Kong are part of the Chinese people.
Right.
So the selection of a chief executive involves the people of Hong Kong, not outsiders, but the people of Hong Kong. What I'm saying is that China should realize that it is not enough for a chief executive to be trusted by China. She has to be trusted by the people of Hong Kong too.
You know, meanwhile, on the private sector side, Hong Kong, even apart from the protests, was facing challenges. Mm-hmm. Now, tourism has dropped like a rock, economic slowing. What do you see happening there, and how important is that to Hong Kong's future?
Well, potentially it could be disastrous if the international community thinks that Hong Kong no longer has the qualities required of an international financial center. Then Hong Kong cannot operate. And I don't think China wants that, because China benefits from that. China has been talking about turning Shanghai into an international financial center, but it hasn't happened. I don't see it happening in the near future. The Chinese currency remains unconvertible. So I think that China needs Hong Kong. Maybe it doesn't need Hong Kong as much as it did 20-some years ago, but it still needs Hong Kong. You know, Deng Xiaoping, what he said in 1979 to the Hong Kong governor on his first visit to Beijing was, investors should set their hearts at ease. So I think investors, foreign investors, should be, their situation should be very carefully considered by the Chinese government. Because once they think that Hong Kong cannot be trusted anymore to function as an international financial center, Hong Kong's whole purpose is lost. It's all gone.
For someone watching developments outside of Hong Kong, what is important to look for, to watch for?
At some point, somebody has to make a move, indicate a readiness to negotiate. And so far, it seems to me the Hong Kong government lacks the authority to negotiate, and that Beijing would not allow it to make any concessions. If you can't make any concessions, you cannot negotiate. I think Carrie Lam has been saying she wants to have a dialogue with people. She's had one session so far. If the dialogues should continue, and there's some progress, that is, people actually speak their minds at these sessions, and the chief executive takes it in and accepts that they are right, they have a point. And she has to change the way she's operating. And China has to give her that room to change. Then maybe there's some hope. And I think that the rhetoric from Beijing is also very important. So far, the rhetoric from Beijing has been like no concessions, no yielding of anything, just being tough, and saying that they have confidence in the chief executive and the Hong Kong police, like they expect the Hong Kong police to solve the problem. I think that if they keep taking that unyielding position, it's very difficult to expect any improvement. So there has to be some indication of a willingness to change, to engage.
Thanks very much, Frank.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Appreciate the time. Frank Chang is a syndicated columnist. He opened the Wall Street Journal's bureau in Beijing in 1979 when the U.S. and China established diplomatic relations. He's also been on staff at the New York Times and the Far Eastern Economic Review, and he's lived in Hong Kong since the early 1980s.
After the housing bust, one woman fought for years to keep her family home.
It's not in my nature to give up.
She was taking on a small group of men who made a killing profiting off the death of the American dream.
It's been the greatest thing I've ever done in my professional life, honestly.
On the next reveal, The Homewreckers.
Tonight at 7, following Bite Marks Cafe.
That is our program on The Conversation today. Up tomorrow, a perspective on how new translations of Hawaiian language newspapers are transforming our interpretation of history. Catherine Cruz will be talking with Puakea Nogelmeyer. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can also drop us an email at talkback@HawaiiPublicRadio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all our past ones are available on The Conversation page at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine's back tomorrow when you can join us for more of The Conversation.